Let's get going because we've got an hour and a half and everyone's got a tight schedule, otherwise we run into other sessions. My name is Nick Gowing, a main presenter for BBC World. The aim of this workshop, and do feel if you want to come forward, then it doesn't feel as if there are quite so many gaps in the audience, if I can encourage you to, because we want to make this a discussion as much as anything else, because I don't think we're going to have much agreement here, or if there is agreement, I'll be very worried. In the next 90 minutes, about one issue, trusting the quality on the internet. And the emphasis is on quality. Can there be quality on the web? Do you think there is quality on the web? And how much lack of quality is there? We want to somehow find out where the current line is on the issue of quality. I'm both a moderator and a kind of parking attendant because there are certain things which I think are going to come up, which I'm going to park to one side on occasions and then come back and rely on me, I will come back to them afterwards. Because sometimes these kind of discussions can go all over the place. But central to all of this is the issue of promoting greater confidence in using the internet and particularly the critical issue of media literacy. Reflecting on the geographical and cultural diversity as well. Some of the issues we want to raise, how reliable or relevant or trusted is content on the internet? What kind of tools can help users seek and retrieve reliable or trusted content? And perhaps how to rate and measure it, how to begin moving down that direction. And then the public service value of the internet, how it's being used. We can't describe the internet in an homogeneous way, but some of the challenges, right from one end of the spectrum where you've got a small number of people using niche internet sites to the major, massive sites right at the other end of the spectrum. It's an essential tool for so many people, everyone, including in my business, on television, on broadcasting. We're constantly referring to websites, particularly the BBC sites where I work. But when we're referring and we're expecting people to pick up details and information from the sites, how good is that information? In other words, the reliability of it all. What we've got up on the table at the front, the panelists, are representatives of institutions, civil society, and media industry and internet players. But there are obviously a host of views that you all have as well, and others will be joining us, including Vin Cerf from Google and Catherine Troutman, who's a member of the European Parliament. But let me just introduce who we have up here. First of all, Andrew Keane, who's written this book, a very controversial book called The Cult of the Amateur. And Andrew, you can tell us the different titles it's been given in different parts of the world. This edition I've got, courtesy of Richard Sambrook, is How Today's Internet is Killing Our Culture and Assaulting Our Economy, particularly the intellectual kleptomaniacs who are pinching stuff from all over the place. And I'm going to ask Andrew to shake the cage a bit at the beginning with his view of how destructive and inadequate the internet can be. Karol Jakubowicz from Poland, who is spending time advising in Kosovo on broadcast matters and is also an advisor to the Council of Europe on broadcasting and has been an active both media scholar and practitioner in Poland. Dzień dobry. I spent 3 years in Poland, which is why I can greet you in that way. Richard Sambrook, who's my boss, I should say, declaring an interest here, who's director of Global News and the Global News Division right across the BBC in London. And finally, Elizabeth Costa, who's representing the International Federation of Journalists, because Aidan White couldn't join us today. And in the front, we also have Matthias Trainer, who's from the Council of Europe, who's chairman of the Committee on Media and New Communications in the Council, and Mark Kelly, representing human rights groups from Ireland, a human rights lawyer and an expert to the Council of Europe as well. Why the Council of Europe? Why the BBC? Well, this is organized by the 8 World Broadcasting Unions, the Council of Europe, the BBC, and the International Federation of Journalists. Central to this is that we believe that there is a challenge, but my job is to moderate this in an impartial way in the good traditions of the BBC. Now, let me ask, first of all, Andrew, if you could rattle the cage a bit with your view of the inadequacies now of the internet.
Thank you very much.
press the button.
Thank you. Nice to be here. I'm not sure if it's the inadequacies of the internet. I think it's the inadequacies of ourselves that's the issue. The internet's just a mirror. When we look at it, we're looking at ourselves, particularly the what's called in Silicon Valley, where I live, the Web 2.0 internet, the internet of content phenomena or anti-content phenomena like YouTube, MySpace, Wikipedia. What the internet has done, what the contemporary internet has done, is lowered the barriers to entry in a way which means that anyone can now use the tools of the internet, the self-publishing tools of the internet, to create content. So you have this eruption of bloggers. You have, I think, about 80 or 90 million bloggers. You have hundreds of thousands, indeed, millions of videographers on YouTube.
This is a new challenge.
Doesn't sound good.
The internet.
It's ticking.
That's frightening.
Pick up where you left off, Andrew.
This is called jamming.
German?
Jamming.
Oh, jamming. So yeah, you have this eruption of content. Hundreds of thousands of videographers on YouTube. Hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of amateur editors on Wikipedia, tens of millions of self-broadcasters on MySpace and Facebook. So what does this mean in terms of quality? You have an abundance of content, an abundance of information, an abundance of entertainment. But in my view, most of it is of an extremely low quality. That's the title of my book, Cult of the Amateur. The vast majority of the content on today's internet is amateurish. It's poor quality. It's indulgent. It reflects, particularly, I think, in America, the narcissism, the sort of corrupt individualism that lies at the heart of the culture. The idea that we are all now able to broadcast ourselves, so we edit blogs, electronic diaries about what we had for breakfast. We use Web 2.0 companies like Twitter to announce to the world when we're getting on and off for a flight, who we're meeting for lunch. We use Facebook to announce our personal preferences in movies or music. Essentially then, the internet has become, and this isn't a criticism of the internet, this isn't a criticism of technology, it's a criticism of ourselves. The internet has become an environmental catastrophe, a digital catastrophe, a cacophony of generally worthless and irrelevant, narcissistic and often corrupt information. There are a couple of other problems with the nature of today's internet. Because the traditional ecosystem in media is being undermined, because editors and producers and the other professional individuals who stand between the creator and the audience are being undermined, disintermediated, simply made redundant. So much of the information is unverifiable, which means that many of the so-called authors on the internet aren't who they claim to be. Anonymity then on the internet is a curse. Anonymity is creating the poor quality, the corrupt quality of much of the content on the internet. Much of that anonymity is being used by corporations to peddle their own message. Some of it's being used by terrorist organizations, others by crazy individuals. Some, as on YouTube a few days ago, by a mass murdering Finnish adolescent who used YouTube to announce the fact that he was going to murder as many of his schoolmates as he could, and indeed went out and murdered them, even though he'd broadcast this on YouTube a couple of days earlier. Now, what does that mean to quality? That doesn't, what I'm not saying that there isn't any quality on the internet. There still is talent. As Barry Diller, the great American mogul, said, talent is always scarce. That is the one truth about media. Talent is always finite, irrespective of technology, irrespective of how many people have access to the internet. There are always talented people. There are talented bloggers. There are talented videographers on YouTube. But given this eruption of content, given the garbage being spewed every second by this new narcissistic culture online, it's increasingly hard to find that content. And given the fact that media has been disintermediated, given the fact that editors and public and fact checkers and journalists are being laid off, at least I think in America and in Western Europe, in droves, there are fewer and fewer people to actually sort out the garbage. There are fewer and fewer curators. The gatekeepers have been replaced by the masses. And the whole purpose of the gatekeeper in media history was to find the good stuff, polish it up, and distribute it. So overall, I'm rather pessimistic and concerned. I wrote my book as a polemic, as a reaction to the utopianism at the heart of a lot of the Web 2.0 ideologies. My argument is that there is quality on the internet, but it's a tiny proportion of the stuff being published, and it's increasingly hard for people to find it. And of course, most importantly, in terms of coming back to this issue of media literacy, the kids know how to use technology, but this YouTube generation, children growing up without newspapers, children growing up who are not even watching the news on CNN or the BBC, children who are growing up in a culture in which they're purely encouraged to broadcast themselves and assume that that's a good thing. These kids have no media literacy. They have no way of distinguishing conceptually between content on Wikipedia, which lacks editorial credibility, and Britannica. They have no ways of understanding that the video on YouTube is different from the video put out by television or Hollywood. So overall, I think this is a profound challenge, indeed potentially even a crisis for the children growing up on the internet. Mass media illiteracy in an age where we need literacy, and where the great challenge for us, I think, as professionals, is figuring out how to provide media literacy in a media dominated more and more by the free market and by the idea that we are all able to distinguish the garbage from the quality when most of us can't. Thank you.
Well, those of you who disagree, hold your fire for the moment, because I need to hear from you in a moment, but I need to just check one thing. What do you see which is good? How do you see improvement happening, even among the younger generation? There are many out there in education who say the kids are much smarter than you might suggest.
Well, I might have called my book, rather than The Cult of the Amateur, The Cult of the Child. It's this idea that children know best now, and the less learned they are, the more innocent they are, the more they know. Jimmy Wales, the founder of Wikipedia, put it best as the classic idealist. What Wales said is, I trust a 14-year-old school child as much as a Harvard professor. It's this idealization of innocence, which I find very troubling. On the other hand, as I said, the internet is a mirror. When we look at it, we're looking at ourselves, and there's a lot of good things on the internet. The irreverence, the energy, the excitement. But in order to be critical, and I think one of the problems with the internet is it's creating a culture of criticism. In order to be critical, you have to understand the news. In order to be satirical about what's going on in Iraq, you have to know what's happening in Iraq. And the problem, I think, with the contemporary internet is it's rejected the notion of authoritative information, and indeed the very idea of the author, the very idea of the expert and the professional. So for me, the big challenge is rebuilding the credibility of the professional and the expert using the technology of the internet, because it's not the internet that's bad, it's us collectively who have gone wrong.
For those arriving late, we're going to examine the issue of media literacy. Let me go to a representative of the traditional media. Richard, gatekeepers being replaced by the masses. That was the warning a few years ago. Are people like me, people like those who work for you in the BBC, being replaced by the masses, or is there a fundamental change and added value to brands?
I don't think it's a question of substitution. It's not either or. I don't think it's about being replaced, but there is a huge disruption to the media going on that's led by the internet technologies and the services that are following. And I think media literacy is the important part at the heart of that. People need to understand the basis of what they're looking at and what it stands for and what its values are and how accountable it is. And I think that's not always transparent, it's not always clear. For the mass media, in fact, that's casting that role, then it is very challenging. You're seeing in the American newspaper industry in particular at the moment something that looks close to a crisis in terms of falling revenues, falling readership, unable to sustain a wide news gathering base. Boston Globe doesn't have any overseas bureau, I think, anymore. The business model for the New York Times isn't clear, so its publisher said it didn't know whether it would be existing print in 5 years' time or not, and he added that he didn't care because he believed the future was online. Now, there are all sorts of opportunities in that as well. There's a lot of good things about that, and the internet, the functionality and the technology allows all sorts of value to be brought to public debate and to public space that you couldn't do 10 or 15 or 20 years ago. But I think the gatekeeper role, as it's traditionally been held, started as a function of resource, really. Only certain organizations had the resources to find out what was happening around the world, and only certain organizations had the resources to distribute it. And that's gone, so that gatekeeper role has disappeared forever. I lead the BBC's World Service, and for 75 years we've been making programs and broadcasting them around the world with studios and lines and transmitters. Now anybody with a laptop and an internet connection and some free software can do the same thing with a podcast. So it's hugely disruptive and it's changed enormously, but I don't think it undermines the value of the big media players. So when I look at, for example, public service broadcasters like the BBC, we maintain a network of 40 bureau around the world because we're publicly funded. If we were commercially funded, we probably couldn't afford to do that. And there is a real public value in first-hand eyewitness reporting that that enables us to do, which actually a lot of other news services don't set out to do or even try to do. Google is the, I think, fourth most respected news brand in the world, but it doesn't originate any content at all. It doesn't set out to. It provides all sorts of other value in different ways, but it's not originating content. So it's in a different game, it's providing value in a different way. But sometimes the things get confused. People say, why do we need the BBC when we've got Google? Well, because Google lives off what we produce and what other mainstream producers produce. So I think there is a strong role for mainstream media still, who are clear about their values, who have transparency and accountability. Their role is changing and evolving in the face of huge disruption from the internet. But I think media literacy, so people understand what the difference is between an organization that has 40 bureau first-hand reporting discovering what's going on in the world versus an organization which simply aggregates what other people are doing, that's really important for people to understand, and it is about literacy at the heart of it.
Andrew makes a point, and I'm summarizing here, don't really overstate the credibility of niche sites from the smallest to the biggest, even YouTube. In other words, the credibility is already at stake there. Do you feel challenged at the BBC?
No, I don't think we've... Well, what you mean by challenged? I mean, of course it's a challenge because...
Well, you're saying that the gatekeeping issue has changed or the role has changed, but he's making the point that actually much of what's out there simply isn't credible enough, so it shouldn't be challenging people like us.
I think it's, again, I don't think it's an either-or thing in that way. There is much out there which is not credible. There's much out there which is low quality, but there's much out there which is extremely high quality. Some of it comes from traditional media organizations. Some of it comes from new organizations. I think of sites like Global Voices, which aggregates blogs from around the world. It's an extremely high-quality site, very interesting, produces content and insight in a way that, frankly, mainstream organizations, even like the BBC, don't yet do. Now, you may learn some of those tricks and absorb them and so on as well, but I think you can't simply say new niche sites are bad, old traditional sites are good. I think it's a lot more mixed than that and complicated than that, and I think we have to get down to some fundamental values. There's good and bad on both sides.
Catherine Troutman has joined us. Thanks. You're slipping into the discussion. I warned them that you would be arriving a little later. Let me move on to Carol. Your view from Central Europe. But particularly the analysis of quality. Who's providing it, who's not providing it on the net?
Well, I'm glad you mentioned Central Europe. In Central Europe, we understand about revolutions. How do you know there's a revolution going on? New people are saying new things in new ways. new people are using new language, and it is always disruptive, but public change in public discourse means there's a revolution going on. How did we know there was a solidarity revolution? New people were saying new things in a new language. And it is no good trying to take the clock back. It is no good trying to change history or to stop history. You have to accept what is happening. We are in the midst of a semiotic revolution. We are also in the midst of a semiotic democracy. Anybody can say anything to anybody. This is a huge improvement over what used to be in the past. There is a first law of technology which says we overestimate the short-term impact of technology. We underestimate the long-term impact. And this is what's being demonstrated here. One of the questions that we are supposed to answer is, what do users want from the internet? The users who are successively moving into cyberspace, who are successively satisfying more and more of their needs on the internet and via digital technology, want everything from the internet, from the raw expression of somebody's stream of consciousness to the most rarefied achievements of science and art. Now, people want different content of different quality for different purposes and for different needs. And if they come across on the internet, on YouTube, the life story of an 80-year-old Englishman who used to be a hit on YouTube because he was telling his life story in a certain kind of way which people identified with, what you're getting is not literature, what you're getting is not art, but you're getting something unique, inimitable, and true. True in a way that was never possible before. So we in the Council of Europe, we are very, very much in favor of this semiotic democracy and semiotic revolution. In the recent recommendation on measures to promote the public service value of the internet, the Council of Europe has called for promoting the active participation of the public in using and contributing content to the internet and the ICTs. There is a very honorable tradition going back to the 19th century of aristocrats and artists moaning over the rebellion of the masses, moaning over their art being encroached upon by the market, by amateurs, this is not really a productive attitude. What we should learn from what is happening is that different content of different quality is needed for different purposes. And we should be thankful to the internet for providing this. The Council of Europe, and I will stop here, wants to promote quality on the internet, among other things, by promoting public domain information, accessibility via the internet. In other words, information produced by public institutions, by adapting and extending the remit of public service media so that public service media may operate on the internet and may contribute to the internet the skills and the ability that they have to produce high quality content, to promote an open offer of services, in particular, for example, by having public administration engage with the citizens through user-generated resources, communities, rather than official websites, facilitating reusers, meaning those wishing to exploit existing digital resources in order to create future content and services, encouraging the reuse of public data by non-commercial users, and so on. So we are very much in favor of this semiotic revolution. We think quality can be defined in different ways, not only artistic quality, not only literary quality, but also the quality of experience, which you can now get and which you could never get before. And therefore, this discussion needs to begin with a definition of quality, because otherwise we're going to get bogged down in unproductive attitudes.
Well, let's try and do that now. Carol, let me just push you one stage further. He didn't use these phrases, but let me quote two or three phrases from Andrew's book. He says, many with no more talent in the creative arts than our primate cousins are creating an endless digital forest of mediocrity. He's referring there to Huxley's infinite monkey theorem. Secondly, amateur hour has arrived, and the audience is now running the show. Thirdly, a generation of intellectual kleptomaniacs is pinching intellectual property and masquerading it as their own. Now, obviously, I'm just picking some highlights there. He's very restrained, given some of the phrases you've used. Do you accept that kind of analysis when it comes to trying to define quality on the net?
Absolutely. I'm an intellectual kleptomaniac myself.
And you're on the record.
And I pinch a lot of stuff from the internet, and I'm not bothered by it.
Without sourcing it?
No. Of course I source it. But we should take advantage of what is being created, rather than to wring our hands and moan over the disadvantages of what is being created. There are lots more advantages, I think.
And Richard, do you accept those kind of phrases when it comes to quality, broadening it out from just solely the BBC interests?
I personally think it's a little bit of a false debate. I mean, of course that's true of some content, and it's not true of a lot of other content. There is good, there is bad, there is everything in between. And if people, you know, choose to indulge in some kind of low quality content on the internet of whatever kind, you know, that's their prerogative. The issue for me is for them to understand what it is that they are looking at. Media literacy is at the heart of it. There's every spectrum of content out there, and that's fine, and that's a good thing, probably. The key thing is that people understand, and there's a media literacy point, what it is they're looking at.
And do you think there is that power of discrimination in most generations now?
No, it's still a reasonably new technology and platform, and it's still developing very rapidly, and so media literacy needs to keep up with it. I mean, Facebook is the latest phenomenon this year. There'll be another one next year, I expect. When I talk to people about Facebook, they don't understand how the data is used on it. They don't understand exactly what underlies it. They don't understand how, you know, some of what they put up there is the copyright of Facebook, and they're able to sell it on, and, you know, what exactly the extent to which some of the risks they're opening themselves to. There are media literacy issues about using social networking sites. It doesn't mean the site's bad. It just means that the people who use it need to understand how it works.
Right. Elizabeth? The International Federation of Journalists, you also work in the Globo newsroom here. What's your view, and what are your concerns from the IFJ? Do you believe that quality is suffering at the moment or not?
I think yes, because talking about professional journalism that IFJ is concerned on, and all the unions affiliate to it, and also here in Latin America and Brazil, I think that the challenge for IFJ is to keep the higher possible patterns of working for journalists to respect of the principles of accuracy, integrity, accountability of the information. And we have tried not to do things in various ways. One is to train people all around the world, because if you say that professional journalists do not need training, I will tell you that yes, we have to have training on basis of how to do to write the in internet or media training, because of the low pattern all around the world. We are not talking about Europe. We are not talking about the. We are talking about more than 3,000 organizations around the world which deal with journalism and information. And I think that the patterns of good journalism it's a very hard thing to keep all around the world. Not only because of technical matters, but also because I can talk about my continent in Latin America because of two other causes. One is the extreme hard conditions of the journalists in working places. IFJ always says that it can't be freedom of expression when journalists are submitted to condition of corruption, pressure, or fear. And I may say that journalists all around the world not only pressure of governments or political or economical, but also internal pressures in the newsrooms. And this thing, the conditions of day-to-day producing news or producing journalism, the hard, the most of the many hours being in the newsroom, and also we have made a survey in Latin America now, and from the 13 countries in Latin America, 7 countries do not even have bargaining, collective agreement for journalists to ensure payments, to ensure their rights. And when you see the condition where journalists are working all around the world, I can say, how can you ensure quality in those conditions? In Latin America, we have journalists receiving the average of $250 a salary in this country. How can you grant quality if journalists are working in these conditions? That's a question. I think that we have a very much strong fight to improve this condition, and also working of my continent and also about the world, the extreme concentration of media ownership. And this is in my country, in Brazil, with in the communication media was born private, even broadcast. We don't have public broadcast in Brazil. We have only private or governmental ones. And in Latin America also, and the extreme concentration of ownership in the country, and now is being put in the external capital, as Murdoch and Cisneros that you all know all around the world. And then when you put all the media in hands of, in Brazil, 7 families, produces everything people sees and read and hear. I think it's very difficult to keep quality in internet when you have so many few sources of, when you don't have pluralism in sources of information.
But doesn't the internet create that plurality, create that democratization? And that's the point of the internet at every level. So I explain your argument there, that having a small number of controllers of internet sites is making it more difficult. So what's happening to all the other niche internet sites out there and the challenge that they are creating?
Yes, I think it's a very good thing when you see that are many sources, but I can tell you, I work in the newsroom as an international news editor of television news that goes at 8 by night, and writing about Latin America, for instance, I can't have information of my country. I say that sometimes I know more about Pakistan and United States and England and all than information that comes from Latin America.
So you're saying this is a failure of the internet almost,
yes,
in Latin America,
I think,
at the moment. And we were hearing from the minister this morning,
yes,
the fact that the pipes are not there yet, the pipes for the internet are still not well established on this continent.
Not even in Brazil or Latin America at all.
Okay.
It's hard to get information from what's happening in this continent, even in the internet.
All right. Does anyone else want to jump in very quickly with your view, please? Do we only have one mic or do we have several mics?
There's one here.
Okay. Can I just pass it around quite quickly? Anyone else want to have a word about the issue of quality, please? Only quality of the internet.
All right. That's probably to Andrew then. At the same time that everybody can produce content on the internet, I think that it's also true that the internet itself and its community has come up with a couple of mechanisms that can help us look at the content in the internet and see what's what looks good and what looks bad. And that's exactly how, for example, Google's mechanism work. When you type in a word, what makes a result come up first or come up last? The first result has a lot of links to it, and Google understands it, those links, as recommendations. We have mechanisms such as Technorati that helps us look at blogs and see which are the blogs that are most linked to and which are the blogs that are less linked to. So I think that at the same time we can produce a lot of content and people produce a lot of content in the internet, we can start relying a little more on that wisdom of the crowds concept to help us define what's good and what's bad.
Accept that or not?
No.
Okay. Microphone.
No, not at all. A couple of thoughts on that. Firstly, I think that the wisdom of the crowd premise is based on one big error. It's the idea that we should give away our intellectual labor for free. One of the curious ironies of Google is that we all contribute to its intelligence, its artificial intelligence, but none of us are rewarded for that contribution. None of us are rewarded when the stock price goes through the roof. So coming back to the issue of how journalists are rewarded, one of the most troubling things I find about the internet, Web 2.0 media, is that people are encouraged to give away their intellectual labor for free. That's become the fashion. Somehow there's this altruistic ethic at the heart of this thing. And if you stand up and say, I actually want to be paid for my intellectual labor, you're considered to be selfish or antisocial or some other absurd pejorative. So I reject that notion. But also, and more importantly, I don't think this wisdom of the crowd thing works. I think it's the reality of these crowd mechanisms on the internet is actually resulting in what I would call the emergence of a new kind of oligarchy, an anonymous oligarchy of web activists. When you look at Wikipedia, for example, which is supposed to reflect the wisdom of the crowd, the reality, even Jimmy Wales acknowledges it, is only a tiny proportion of Wikipedia editors who are doing all the writing. When you look at these so-called democratized taste engines like Reddit or Rojo, the reality is that they're controlled and managed by web activists. Most people don't have the time to enter their desires and interests and positions into these engines. Right. So the reality is it's less democratic. Democratization is resulting in new oligarchies, which particularly concern me.
Right. I told you I'd be a bit of a parking attendant. Given that Vint Cerf may walk through the door at any moment, and you've raised Google, let's just hold that for 1 minute. I'd like to pick up, I know you two of you have the microphone, on this issue of the wisdom of the crowd and Andrew rejecting it, the new oligarchy of web activists. Let's just concentrate on that for a moment, because that's central to his book. Are you going to talk about
yeah,
this?
Yeah, I'd like to comment about the quality of the press first, the contents.
No, hang on. I'm asking about this, the wisdom of the crowd and whether that is helping or hindering quality.
Well, I think the quality basically between the press and the internet content is about the same. I don't believe that is too much differences. Not all the press is the same quality like BBS, BBC. We know around the world, several of the press, they actually doesn't really practice in the ethic of the code. And are you saying their content is better than anything in the internet? I don't think so. And also in the young generation, don't underestimate, they know what is true, what is joke. So you don't need to underestimate the judgment of the young generation. They know what is the content they are reading for from the internet.
Richard?
Well, I think it's true. A lot of young people absolutely understand what they're seeing, but I don't think you can assume it's true of everybody. And anecdotally, and we may all have different anecdotes, of course, prove very much, but anecdotally I speak to, I go and talk to school children and classes and so on, and I'm often struck by the fact that they have taken something at face value that may not merit it. So I agree with you. I think it's very easy for an older generation and so on to assume they understand nothing, and that's not true. They have many teenagers and so on have a quite sophisticated understanding of the quality of content that they're looking at, but it's not true of everybody.
Can I just ask you to discipline yourselves? Let's just pick up. We're talking about the quality of the internet and this issue of the wisdom of the crowd, true or false, or somewhere in the middle. Can you just restrain yourself? Those who want to talk about it, please. It will.
Okay, work for France 24, which is a, let's say, a competitor of the BBC, and I'm here to represent the World Press Freedom Committee. I think talking about the wisdom of the crowd, we don't care about that. As journalists, what we want to find is raw material, which is interesting. For example, in Burma, the only images from the repression came from people who are not professional journalists. And as journalists, our job is to check this content, whether or not it's true, or we are being manipulated. It's all about checking. Our value as journalists is to check the information, which is a work which is not done on YouTube or other user-generated content websites. So that's why at France 24 we've set up a user-generated content desk that I'm running to just dedicate it to checking the content and the accuracy of the content. And I can tell you it's a hard job. I'm doing that every day. Is it something you think of doing at the BBC, or if you don't, how do you handle that?
Yes, briefly, we have a similar system. We have a desk which takes in all of the user content sent into us, and we don't use any of that without having verified it first. Yeah,
I can tell you that as someone who's sitting in the presenter's seat. We can see the material coming in. We want to make sure that it's there, just like on France 24. But let me pick up on that point as well, Andrew. You talk about, let's pick up on this point of the wisdom of the crowd and you challenging it. When you look at something like Burma, which is the most extreme example recently, surely that shows the immense power of the internet as a democratizing medium and technique, even if we have to check it a lot. Microphone.
Yeah, my critique is really of the advanced industrial world. When it comes to a place like Burma, which doesn't have press freedom, I'm all in favor of the internet. I think that I have a great deal of respect for what bloggers are doing in terms of risking their lives. But it's an entirely different experience and an entirely different situation from, say, Burma, from the US or from the UK or Western Europe or Japan. In countries where there is press freedom, where people don't get put in jail for their views, the internet's being used in a very different way. That's why, again, for me, it's not about the evils of the internet. What's interesting about the internet is it's a mirror. When we look at it, we're looking at ourselves. So when one can actually be critical of the way the internet's being used in the UK or in the US and actually be very sympathetic in Burma. So it's not my critique is not a blanket criticism of technology.
All right. Let's just pick up on this crowd business and the symbol of, say, Wikipedia.
On the crowd question, just very recently I saw a program in which the viewers were supposed to call in and vote on whether Mozart or Madonna was more innovative. Well, it was one of the silliest questions I've ever seen. It was a beautifully produced program on a superb channel, BBC World. It was done by a superb journalist, Michel Hussain. It just shows that even the best of us can be infected by the notion that the crowd has something interesting to say.
Richard?
I didn't see it, but I mean, I think, as I said before, all channels, even the BBC, can sometimes attempt to be entertaining as well, and I don't think that can have been a very literal question, expecting a literal answer, but it may have been part of a broader and hopefully more entertaining debate. So as I said before, there's a place for entertainment as well.
We are talking about the quality of the internet here, Andrew.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. I mean, I think the biggest weakness in my argument, as someone has suggested at the back, is I idealize mainstream media. I think that's true. My critique of mainstream media is that it itself has fallen under the seduction of the cult of the amateur. The worst aspects of mainstream media, in my view, are call-in radio, reality television, and popularity contests like American Idol. My challenge to mainstream media is of it to be more authoritative, more arrogant, more reminding people of its expertise. Because I think when mainstream media begins to apologize for itself and suggest that it doesn't really know anything and that it needs to acquire its knowledge from the masses, from the crowd, whatever other word you want to use, that essentially spells the end of mainstream media. So, you know, I'm in huge admiration of what the BBC does, what Richard does, and I think that the BBC needs to be more aggressive in terms of reminding the world of its authority, its professionalism, and the fact that this can't be replicated by 14-year-old kids in their underpants in their bedrooms.
Yet, and I suppose I'm meant to be impartial, but I have to say there are many 14-year-old kids in their bedroom who actually know how to use a digital camera, who can point it outside, and when they see something burning or something happening, they can then become our eyes and ears. Okay, we have to mediate it, right. But that's the power of the internet, surely, a digital technology, that someone is there and able to do it, whether in Burma or East London, or here in
but
Berlin.
But our friend from the French television station, he and I did a panel in Berlin a couple of weeks ago, and he reminded us that this media requires even more professionals, because he knows in Burma that a lot of the stuff he's getting in is made up, that he's needing to distinguish between stuff that is invented, stuff that's mislabeled, that is supposed to have happened one day when it happened another day. So if anything, what the internet does is actually require more professional media people, more experts, because otherwise we're all misled. We have no idea what we're looking at.
Please.
Thank you very much, Michael Carlin, Caring for Our Future project. I'd like to put this in an anthropological perspective. You have one half of the world which is accepting change reluctantly, and the other half which is embracing it enthusiastically. If you look at junk food, for example, and its history, today people are demanding quality, and the same thing will happen with information. So there's nothing wrong with the technology of change, the changing technology. I think the issue is, the most difficult issue is to change the business model so that you can continue to announce the news, capture the news, interpret the news, distribute the news, provide excellent documentaries, which the BBC has set a world standard in quality in doing, but and offer forums for debate, and recognize that most of what is not good quality falls into the entertainment sphere. Of course, there's quality, different levels in serious information, but most of what is, let's say, repugnant to people or something like that tends to fall into the entertainment sphere. Again, it's a business model, and it's up to the society, the user today, who's more educated, to choose what he's prepared to let his, to want to see, what he's prepared to let his children see, within, obviously, rules that governments are there to sort of...
All right, we're talking about media literacy, and there's one over there, and there are other commentators I will come to. Over there, please, here, and over here. Again, the quality of the internet, media literacy, stand up, yeah, and let's
actually,
hear what you have to
I
say.
Had a comment and a question on the wisdom of crowds. I don't know if
okay,
I'm still on time.
I want to move on after
yeah,
that,
just
please.
The last one, and was one point that I don't think has been covered but has been mentioned by the speaker, which is the wisdom of crowd. Is just another form of oligarchy. And my question is, isn't also professional news, professional journalism, in many instances a form of oligarchy? And I wonder whether we should stop comparing the internet to an idealized world and just compare it with the real world that we have, in which many cases of, there are, at least in Italy, there have been many cases which journalists didn't do their job, and the reason why we knew about, for example, a recent scandal about the abduction of an Arab citizen by the CIA in the Italian territory was first brought up thanks to the power of the wisdom of crowds, thanks to the internet, and not by major news outlets. Now, I understand that the BBC probably has a higher professional standard than Italian news. I can accept that, but the world is not the BBC. So
okay,
I would like
you.
A comment on why do we compare the wisdom crowds or anything else on the internet to another world, and we don't make the same comparison to the real world that we have in front of us?
This is an important point, isn't it, Andrew? You're trying to compare apple and oranges almost, and therefore there's a fundamental flaw in your argument.
Why?
Well, internet and the traditional media.
But I'm not suggesting that traditional media works off the wisdom of the crowds. They work off entirely different principles. Traditional media works off the wisdom of the expert. Richard pays a group of seasoned journalists to live and work in Iran or Iraq. He has another group of seasoned experts in London deciphering and editing their content. And then ultimately, out of that collective wisdom of an elite, a group of meritocratically elected, if you like, or self-elected people, you get the news. It's entirely different. And the same process happens in Hollywood, in publishing, in both the entertainment and information businesses. That's an entirely different principle from Google News or some of these other wisdom of the crowd networks, where anyone can participate and one has no idea who they are, how many times they vote, how often they're actually participating in this thing. So the difference between Richard's network is it's entirely accountable. We know who these people are. They're paid. They have names. They're, you know, and they're fired when they get things wrong. It's an entirely different thing. So you can't. I agree. You can't compare the two. One is really good, and one isn't.
Yeah, just briefly. I mean, I think we're falling into the kind of false dichotomy of good and bad, either or, again. There's good and bad in mainstream media, and there's good and bad in new media and in new technology services and so on as well. I think the issue, sort of come back to the same thing, it's about media literacy, and that applies to old media as much as it does to new media. The issue for me in terms of old media is about values and accountability. And you're right, as a public broadcaster, like other public broadcasters, the BBC is accountable, and you know, people are chased up if they get things wrong and can be fired and all the rest of it. It's not always true. Even in newspapers, aren't as accountable as that or aren't as transparent as that. So it's media literacy is not just a thing about the internet. Media literacy applies across the board, I think.
You wanted a word?
Yeah, there is this notion that, and it's a meritocratic myth, that somehow talents are equally distributed to everyone across the world and that we are all capable of producing high quality content. I mean, it's quite simply not true. If you want good content, you have to pay for it. And I wonder whether Richard, because we are also trading on another myth that somehow the BBC is some unassailable edifice creating good content. The fact is that the BBC, they're going through a budgetary revolution as well at the moment, with money being, with departments being slashed 10% across news gathering. I wonder whether, Richard, you could tell people about that and what is the rationale behind that? What is the thinking behind that? Because if you do want good news gathering, if you do want good high-quality documentaries, you've got to pay for it.
Or do you want a separate breakout session, Richard?
No, okay. Look, I mean, very briefly, I'm not here to say the BBC is the beacon or is the unassailable at all. I mean, there's a lot of that we do that needs to be better, and there's a lot of things that we could and should do differently, and so on. So well, that's generally not my position.
But do you fear for that notion of quality in the future?
Well, I mean, I think you can't take the future for granted. And, the BBC, like many, many other organisations, is going through a rapid change in the face of the disruption brought about by the internet and by what that technology allows. And, the current strategy assumes that on-demand is going to be a stronger and stronger feature of how people want to consume content in the future. And that as someone who has grown up as a linear broadcaster, initially in radio and then in television, and admittedly got into the internet quite early, but I think it's actually kind of fallen behind in terms of functionality on the internet, we have got to completely reorganize how we produce content, how we distribute content, and we've got to understand what our audience is, what the public wants in this new age of on-demand services. And that's exactly what we're going through. That's why we're cutting back on some areas and investing in others, and it's a huge change process. And yes, it's painful for an organization like the BBC, but that's life, and many, many other organizations all around the world going through exactly the same thing, driven by the same disruption that this technology is bringing to the business.
Now, I don't want you to think I'm pushing the pressure away from Richard, but we are here to discuss the quality of the internet, not the BBC, so let's be clear about that if we can. Right, we have four commentators here, and Vint has just arrived. Catherine's also here. Mark Kelly, human rights lawyer from Dublin. Pick up on some of these issues as you see them, particularly when it relates to human rights and NGOs.
Okay, thank you, Nick. I mean, I have to say, firstly, I'm actually quite annoyed with myself at how annoyed I am by Andrew Keane's remarks, because that's obviously exactly the response that you're intending to produce with this particular piece of polemic. At least I'm assuming it's that rather than bitterness that you didn't buy Google shares a number of years ago when they were available at a lower stock price.
Did you think of buying them, Andrew?
I didn't have any money. So.
Well, maybe the royalties from the book will help with that. I have to say, I'm particularly struck by two of the reactions to Andrew's comments from the panel. Firstly, a non-verbal thing, just how relaxed Richard Sambrook looks on the panel this afternoon as head of news at the BBC. He doesn't strike me as someone who feels particularly...
Director of the Global Division.
Director of Global Division, and you're Bosnic. He doesn't look to me like someone who feels particularly under pressure from these movements. And then from Carol, I thought it was very nice that he asked the question, how do you know that there's a semiotic revolution going on? And it's because, he said, new people are saying new things. And I would add to that, you also know that there's a semiotic revolution going on when vested interests feel threatened and they start to squeal. And when people who hold themselves out to be experts start to feel challenged. And I greatly welcome, as someone who is paid to be a Council of Europe expert from time to time, I greatly welcome the challenges that these changes in the information society are throwing up. This is probably the first time in history ever when people who maybe Andrew would regard as the great unwashed, for the first time, have access to communication technologies and the possibility to share and communicate information on almost the same basis that he does. And that sort of democratization of information, I think, is and communication is a massive leap forward. But of course there are challenges, and I wanted just briefly to mention one that I confront in another professional capacity. I teach these days in university, and I teach postgraduate students, and I've been absolutely staggered really over the past year to discover on a number of occasions postgraduate students handing in work that has been taken really without any kind of critical analysis directly from websites. I'm not talking about plagiarism, but I'm talking about people taking information as primary sources from, let's say, the Council of Europe in a completely uncritical way. Now, I have to ask myself, as a so-called expert, as a so-called university lecturer, how is it that these people, who are not 14-year-olds in their underpants in their bedrooms, they're 21, 22-year-olds postgraduates in a distinguished university in Ireland, how is it that they've got to that age and do not have the critical or analytical faculties to break that information down in the way that they should? And the conclusion I reach is that perhaps the people, the self-elected elites that Andrew has been talking about, perhaps haven't done their job properly along the way. And I'd like to put it back to the panel that perhaps if those of us who do hold ourselves out to be experts and professional journalists continue to do what we do best, which is to check and double check and treble check against primary sources and to foster genuine critical analysis, then I would suspect that we'll always have a job and that the quality of what we do will always be recognized in one form or another. So I think the real challenge, and on that I'll conclude, is to refocus our energies on how do we promote genuine media literacy so that new generations who have access to these technologies, and the ivory towers of the past are gone. The days when BBC newsreaders had to wear a black tie, even if they were on radio, will not return, and thank goodness for that. How do we make sure that the kind of values that the Council of Europe is calling for in its new recommendation on the public service value of the internet are actually turned into reality? And I would suggest that those of us who hold ourselves out to be experts should be focusing on that rather than on bemoaning the demise of self-elected elites.
You're moving us on to the second half of the session. What would you table? You have the microphone before we go to Matthias. What would you table as what needs to be done for those postgrads who are some of the intellectual kleptomaniacs? Do they source it, by the way, with footnotes?
Oh, it's properly sourced with footnotes. Well, I rather fear that we're already...
What has to be done to institutionalize this?
Well, I think we may be slightly too late where they're concerned, which is why we need to be looking, I think, now right back at primary school level at how we build media literacy and awareness of the new technologies into the way that we teach children.
All right, Matthias, reminder, you're chairman of the committee, or the steering committee on media and new communications for the Council of Europe. Pick up that point.
Yeah, I pick up that point. I mean, as regards the Council of Europe's view and policy as such, I just can endorse that what Carol has said. That's exactly how we see it. We see the whole evolution, this whole as a big, big evolution. We will talk in future. Was this before or after the invention of the internet? This is the big, let's say, change, and therefore also the behavior of people, the expectations of people, and how they socialize, for example, has completely changed in many fields. I just say 8 seconds today can be a time where we say, well, this page doesn't open. 8 minutes or 8 hours was a sensation when we got maybe a phone call in earlier days. So this is a big, big revolution. So the answer of the Council of Europe to all that is really this empowerment, this media literacy, starting a concept, starting at the very early age of pupils already, and confronting them really with not only the challenges of the new media, but also with their responsibilities. Just one point I want to say to Andrew Keane's book, which I haven't read so far, but I'm looking forward to reading it with pleasure. On the one hand, I was feeling like exactly like him when I was quoting that yesterday in a workshop, when I was opening YouTube and saw, for example, hundreds of videos, again, I have to quote this example, of vomiting youngsters to show each other at parties, and so on. I was saying, where is this going? At the other hand, and there I have really a big question to Andrew, what are you aiming at? I mean, provocation is good, but you don't offer us so far, but I haven't read your book, any solution. The solution that we say, empowerment, training, that's what we are really aware of and what the Council of Europe is doing. So what is your answer? Do you want a quality test? Do you want to reduce the internet offers or whatever? It's too simple for me just to say that, how did you say, an idealization of innocence. No, there is a high challenge of young people really to be creative, and there are excellent examples.
Andrew, don't answer that yet, because I want to pick up the point from the back, both for Mark and Matthias, that point about don't underestimate the ability of the younger generation, I'm paraphrasing here, to discriminate and to be able to make a judgment about whether information is good or bad. You're saying we can't take that risk now.
We can't
say again.
No, we can't take that risk now that we say we blame, let's say, a whole generation of youngsters in the way that that because we have all these offers that Andrew has quoted, that we say this is the internet generation today, which is producing rubbish. I really have to contradict
that. And Mark.
Well, I think, Nick, what's really happened is that the control of access to quality information is no longer solely in the hands of experts and professors. It has been democratized, and it's time for experts and professors to catch up in the way that they provide critical, analytical education to those with which they have to engage.
Catherine Troutman, your view from the European Parliament about the real challenge, do you subscribe to that or think it's overstated?
I think that what we must be aware of in the work we can do on quality of internet. First, I have a problem with quality of internet. Internet has its own quality, and it's a tool. And we must see what we want for information, for example. I think that the quality can be, the interest for the information of people and young people is a very positive, thing. But the problem is to, as it was said, to verify the sources and the quality of information on the internet. We had now two systems. One was motivated because spectrum, for example, was rare, and we had a capitalistic society or companies for media. Now it's everybody who can give information. We were before in a real freedom in democratic countries for information and with an a posteriori control. Now the problem is who controls the information? Is it auto-control? It is providers? where is the responsibility? I think, for example, journalists, they have an important role. At first, I wondered if the fact that they had blogs was good or not. And I see the success of blogs of journalists, and I think they give a sort of education to the media literacy, because they have instructed commentaries, they know history, they know the sources, they can use the information in an ethical way. So we have the example of good blogs of journalists, and we have also the competition between media. But if I see the example of BBC, BBC is a leader of information in the world. And this gives a sort of pressure on the quality of information of BBC. And we know that we can be almost confident on what we see on the TV, on the screen, or what we listen to. So I think that we need really good media, well supported in a financial way, as you said, a correct budget. And we need also to ask how we can guarantee a sort of pluralism. The pluralism was, the definition of pluralism was in fact an obligation, because we were in a rare situation for the press and for information. Now we have abundance. So it's real different. And the quality will be how to manage the abundance, the financial support, and the control. And this is not completely solved. So I think that European Parliament must look on all these questions, and also in the question of how we can support and give a correct answer to the professionals. Because if we see what we vote for example on cybercrime, we don't look at the consequences for the media, for example, and or for the providers of information or of electronic communication. So we have a real question about the responsibility we give to all the actors of internet through text we can vote for. So I think it's a question of cooperation in preparation of this type of questions. About spectrum, we will have the telecom package in our agenda. It is public today by and presented by our commissioner, Mrs. Reding, and we will discuss about spectrum. What is the quantity of spectrum to information, to public services? This is a real question. So
can I refocus you back onto quality, even if you don't like the word?
Yes, on the quality, I think that it's, the best thing we can do for the quality is to have a real formation for the professionals. If we speak of media, and we can have also, the possibility to give the formation for all the people to the way they use information on the internet, and they provide news on the internet.
Well, you mentioned blogging right at the beginning when it comes to quality. Let me quote something from Andrew's book again. We're blogging with monkey-like shamelessness about our private lives, our sex lives, our dream lives, our lack of lives, our second lives. He talks about it being collectively corrupting and confusing popular opinion, undermining our sense of what is true and what is false. Do you like that? Do you accept it or reject it?
No, I think there is something very, very, very true in that. I think that there is a sort of egosphere, ego era, when people are, combining their life on a screen. It's something very personal, and also a sort of, sometimes I speak of a society of ego, not equal, but ego.
But is
it is a way to make a sort of scene of
the life.
But
is it good quality ego?
Pardon?
Is it good quality ego?
I think the question for that is not quality, it's the exposition of its own life. Here, there is no need of quality. It is just the scene of the proper life. But the quality must be, I think, when we have really a possibility to have a real communication service, information, there it's a necessity of quality. the other side of the sort of personal use or sexual abuse on the internet, this is must be, you know, it's the judge and in the law which can be voted, which is the guarantee. But not the quality is very difficult to be defined because it must be common. So I pray for a sort of reflection by journalists about the quality of information, for example, because I think they can give a real input to the quality of internet by their own contribution.
Vint, I have to tell you that there was a point about Google, which I'm going to raise with you shortly, so stand by. But there are, I want to, not yet, because I want to actually pick up on media literacy first, or continue that on the issue, not specifically about Google. But Carol, given what you have been doing, the kind of work you've been doing in Central Europe, where you're all members of the European Union, by and large now, great expectations of convergence with the most developed nations of Europe. When you see the great spectrum there is on quality, and you're involved, as you say, in helping in universities and teaching and creating outreach and new capacity, how far do you go on this issue of media literacy and the challenge that there has to be, particularly in the marginal countries of Europe, where there's still a problem just getting basic education because of the capacity problem and the funding problems and so on?
Media literacy is obviously very important, and I would agree with Matthias that we have to start, and others, and David also, that we need to start from a very early age. At the same time, let us not exaggerate. I would argue that because there are different types of content on the internet, and because there are different providers of content on the internet, different criteria apply to these different types of content. And whereas people, when they look for information, they need to have the critical ability to judge the information and to decide whether to act upon this information, whether to believe it, whether to accept it as something, as their view of the world. In regard to other areas of internet content, this critical discerning eye is not really truly necessary, because people will be simply guided by their own sense of what they like and what they don't like. So I would, whilst I would agree that media literacy is very important, it is not the answer to everything.
Elizabeth, do you want to add anything on media literacy? On the challenge, particularly here in Latin America?
Yes, I think we have this problem that was spoken here about the quality of standards and codes of conduct and to keep professional standards high. And I think it's always a challenge, and I can't see how to better it, because we must do lots of work on that, on what we say on training and educate people. We work here in Brazil with the principle of that society has the right of information, but in most of places, the exclusion, the social exclusion of all, you all know that in Brazil and in all developing countries, people do not have even the access to internet. They put money on a land house. We don't have public points of internet. We don't have a public policy of including people in the internet, so we must take something that is before that. We must, in many countries, first of all, guarantee the access, and then talking about include people and including sources of information. When you asked me about pluralism, and we talked about the wisdom of the mass, I think there are many organizations in the internet that put information there, but they did not put news. That's what we deal with. We are journalists. We deal with news. We can find many information in the internet, but it's hard to get news, that good news, professional news, checked news, that, as we say that. And we try to train and to do things, but the exclusion of people who can put information in the internet is very hard in many countries, because we don't have information from small groups of people, of women, of poor people. You can't get information from those who are now even excluded from the right to inform, even with the internet.
Thank you. That question, what are you aiming for, Andrew? And you have another point as well.
Well, that's a fair question. Actually, in my book, I dedicate the conclusion to goals. But let me say, What I'm aiming for is media literacy. I think we're all aiming at the same thing. I think we're in complete agreement here. But I think the challenge for educators in media literacy is the real issue here. Catherine said the internet has its own quality, and I think she's right. There's a profound cultural shift going on with the YouTube generation. It's not that they're more or less ignorant, more or less willful. I think that the cultural revolution is about personalization. I was on a panel with Leonard Brody, a Canadian guy who runs a big network called Now Public, a blogging network. He said, and he and I are on completely different ends of the spectrum, but he agreed about this. He said that he thinks the future of information are networks on things like Facebook, that the future of newspapers are personalized networks. This new generation is going through a crisis of trust. The reason why social networks are so powerful is people only trust, this new generation are people who only seem to trust people they know. So the crisis of the expert in a traditional 20th century professional way is that we don't know Richard Sambrook. The person reading the BBC doesn't know the person sitting in Moscow or New York, therefore they don't trust them. So the real challenge, I think, and this is the solution in terms of media literacy, is we've got to figure out how to rebuild depersonalized offices and offices of expertise in a way that conforms to a generation that is going through its own crisis of trust and is, in my view at least, fetishizing social networks and refusing all forms of external authority. We've got to be able to convince the YouTube generation that they, for their news about Iraq, they're better off trusting the professional journalist on the ground than their friend who claims to be blogging from Baghdad. Now, the solution for this is combining the best of two worlds. I'm not suggesting we go back to the analog newspaper. What I'm suggesting is the best solution are combining what the BBC is doing, what Agence France is doing, what The Guardian Online is doing, combining the interactive tools of the web revolution, but at the same time maintaining the focus on expertise, on professionalism. Because if we just do away with the professionalism, then we have anarchy. There is a solution to this. Web 3.0, in my view, will be based on professionalism. These are just tools. If professionals get their hands on these tools, experts, then I think the internet can be a much richer and rewarding place than it currently is.
So, Richard, will the credibility of me as a BBC presenter and you and your channels be improved if there's an enormous Facebook entry for me, which the younger generation can consult?
Social networks are like modern cities, and if you're in the media, you want to go where the people are, so that includes social networks. So there's absolutely a place for the BBC and Facebook and MySpace and other things as well. That's where people choose to congregate digitally, then that's where news organizations and media should be as part of what they do as well, is the first thing. Secondly, I've sympathy with what Andrew is saying. I think it is very important we don't lose professionalism and expertise through these changes. And of course he's right that there is a kind of generational shift in attitude. You know, we're seeing the rise of individualism, loss of deference. That's been going on for some time. One of the solutions, I think, for traditional media through that is to increase transparency and accountability. And that's difficult for organizations that were founded decades ago. It's difficult even for an organization like the BBC. We're pushing ourselves as hard as we can in terms of transparency and accountability. But I think that's what will lead to continuing trust in the future.
Media literacy in the last 10 minutes, please. Several of you have been very patient.
Great, thank you. Hi, my name is Michael Geist. I'm a law professor in Canada. I'm also a blogger, and I've written for the last 8 years a weekly column for some of Canada's largest newspapers. So I've come at it from a number of different perspectives. And I have to say that this notion that mainstream media relies heavily on expertise and experts simply doesn't accord with what the reality is today. The truth is the majority of what you read in your newspaper is a journalist who has a 5 o'clock deadline, who's doing their best to identify a couple of so-called experts. Maybe they call back, maybe they don't. There is virtually nobody providing any kind of editorial oversight over much of what goes on. And moreover, the truth is that these are profit-making entities, and there's nothing wrong with that, but journalists understand that as well. And so there's biases within their coverage. Just take a look at how newspapers will cover the stories of their own circulation. You wouldn't believe that they're all reading from the same report when you take a look at different papers in the same community, because they all have a completely different spin on it. Newspapers further undermine their own credibility by regularly running advertorials and the like. And I think everybody recognizes that there is a political bias within much of this coverage. That's not to say there isn't great journalism in mainstream media, but there's also great journalism that's taking place in the blogosphere. And indeed, if we talk about media literacy, I think the most notable point about the blogosphere is that it's educating people about the shortcomings of mainstream media. That's where I think the real media literacy is taking place today.
Okay, Lee, just bring the microphone forward. Vint, I hope you've picked up the threads of our conversation here, but one of the issues raised, and I said I'd park it in the hope that you would arrive, was addressed particularly to Google about, first of all, we're talking about the quality of the internet. First of all, loosely, the Google rating. And secondly, what Andrew said, he resents giving away his intellectual labor for free. Now, have I about summarized what you said? Or do you want to add to it? Yeah. That's fine. Okay, and then, so we're talking about the quality of internet material, and there's been a very wide debate here from all sides. And secondly, this particular issue.
Well, let me start out by observing that Google doesn't produce the information that's on the internet. It's produced by everyone else. And to the extent that we are permitted to scan that information and index it, we do so. Those of you who know or don't know, there is a robot.txt file that you can put in the front of your website to tell us whether you want us to scan the rest of the website. And if you tell us not to, we will not. And so if someone says, I don't want my material to be found by Google or indexed by Google, we will not index it.
But can I just check? Indexing, does that mean a rating of quality?
No. Indexing is simply a matter of discovering on which page a word appears. And so when someone does a search, we look in our index, which we've constructed by crawling through the internet, avoiding the places where we've been told not to go, and we pull up all the pages that have those words. Now, the next question is ranking. When you say rating, I am thinking, I'm hearing ranking, and I want to make a distinction between the two. The ranking that we do started out with a PageRank algorithm, which was attempting with an algorithm to figure out which content that matched a particular search was more likely to be relevant to the party who was doing the search. And that PageRank algorithm simply said if there were more pages pointing to this place, it probably had a higher value based on the people who decided to point to it. It has nothing to do with Google's algorithm judging anything. It's simply a mechanical process. The process has gotten a lot more complicated than it was when Larry Page and Sergey Brin did the first work, because people discovered that they could monetize their appearance in the rankings. That's what the advertising algorithm did for us. It created a company and a business model, but it also induced behavior in the network for people who decided to put ads up and generate revenue from the content that people appeared to be interested in. So then they began to take actions that would cause the ranking algorithm to artificially increase the apparent value or utility of that information. So we have to counter that.
But to be clear, that's really serving an internal Google purpose as opposed to ranking the quality.
There is nothing that I'm aware of in what Google does that attempts to rank the quality other than these mechanical algorithms. Now, I will say that we've made attempts to identify pages which we believe have been artificially created to point to something so as to artificially increase the page rank. We try to discount that. So we've tried to put more value on the, or increase the weight of pointers coming from pages that appear to be more appropriate. But this is very different from trying to assess, in some deep sense, the absolute quality of the content on the network. There isn't any algorithm that I know of that can do that, and even our complex brains have trouble doing that. So I don't think that you'll find anyone at Google claiming to be able to rate, in the sense of quality, what's up there.
Thank you. And on the media, well, just pick up on that, media literacy as well. You've come in on that part of the discussion. Anything particularly that you can add about what needs to be done, even though you say the human brain is not up to it, probably, but to improve it in the way that we've heard from Matthias and Mark?
There is no question in my mind that the young generation tends to look things up on the net, whether they use Google or Yahoo or A9 or whatever, and then they believe it. Now, this is no different than picking up the newspaper and reading an article about which you know nothing and believing it. And we all do that. We also read articles we know something about, and we find 25 things that are wrong. But this is the way people behave. The one thing that I have tried to teach young children who are using the internet this way is that after they've done a search of that kind, they're not done. The job has only just begun. If you're serious about finding information, a lot of it is not on the net. There are other sources you have to go to. Every single person in the world gets input from a variety of different sources: newspapers, magazines, articles, television, radio, their friends, their parents. And they have to figure out of all that mass of information, what information do they want to accept as valuable and what information do they want to reject. It's called critical thinking. And every human being needs to do that. And believe it or not, we've been doing that for the last 10, 20, 30, 40, 50,000 years, because some information we recognize as valuable and some not. If somebody says, that animal over there will kill you if you wander out in the middle of the plain, this is probably something you should pay attention to. And the ones that didn't survive. Their genes didn't get passed on. This is Darwinian evolution. So in the intellectual sense, we have the same task ahead of us. And that is to take this huge mass of information, which has now become visible to us thanks to this outpouring of content on the net and indexing of it. Now we have to do something to figure out which information do we want to use and accept as valuable. Sorry to just go on and on, but I do want to point out something. In the past, we have had to do the same thing. Forget the internet. Every other publication has had to establish a reputation. The notion of brand and the notion of reputation and the notion of editing has not gone away. The value is probably higher now than it ever was in history, because of the content, the amount of content that we have to evaluate.
Would you say it's the same for Google and a small niche website somewhere out in the boondogs?
The
brand being critical for whether it's you or the little niche website being produced somewhere out in the boondogs?
The brand is something whose value is established in the minds of the people who absorb and use that information. And so it doesn't matter where the website is. I know we're out of time.
Okay, we're almost.
No,
thank you.
Just very quickly, I just wondered if you had anything to share with us about Google Scholar, which does seem to be a new application within Google, free to use, but it does seem as if there's some quality assessment going on there, and I wonder whether that's worth reflecting on.
Let me respond. Google Scholar is an attempt to restrict the base of information from which responses will be taken. So those are refereed publications. We do not mix the refereed publications with any of the other general stuff that's on the net. So if you're finding higher quality there, and I sincerely hope you are, it's because the content that was indexed came from refereed publications. That's the only reason.
Right, one moment, Andrew. Does anyone else want to have a word before I give Andrew the final word? Catherine? Elizabeth? Richard? Carol? No, okay.
But coming back to Google and search, I mean, when people use Google, they assume that that it's a quality search engine. That's why they go there. They're not going there because they want to benefit you in terms of the sale of advertising. People use Google because it's helpful for them. But my premise would be, and I use Google, and it can be very helpful. But if you compare Google, which is based on an artificial algorithm, which we all generate, that Google's wisdom is created by all of us. Every time we enter a search request into Google, it becomes wiser. If you compare Google with, say, a human-created search engine, one that's been created by a friend of mine, Jason Kalkanis, called Mahalo, in which he's paying real people to enter professional curators of search to create a much more credible search engine, I think you'll find that in terms of quality of search engines, a search engine that's created for humans, that is curated by professionals, by experts, is likely to be of a higher quality. It may be more expensive, it may be challenged by different sorts of business models than one that's premised on an artificial algorithm.
And look, I'm not going to stand up here and have a big fight about that because I agree with you. I will point out, however, that Google is attempting to index everything that's on the internet. That's all that we set out to do, and that's what we do. And if you find a subset of information that those human beings have found to search and index, that's wonderful. That's a different objective. Our objective is simply to take everything that people put on the internet and index it and make it accessible.
And my 9-year-old, and I mean he's typical of 9-year-olds, and this is not a criticism of Google, it's just a reality. My 9-year-old now associates Google with truth. Whenever he doesn't believe anything I tell him, which is most of the time, he says, well, let's check it on Google.
This has nothing to do with Google and has everything to do with parent-child relationships. And if you don't
media literacy.
We've run out of time to discuss parent-child relationships. We've really got into a takeoff mode here, and the discussion will continue in part 02 with the public service value, the quality of the internet, again, overseen by the Council of Europe for the forum. Thank you very much indeed. I'm very struck by what Catherine said about whether we need to think about how we define the use of the word quality when it comes to the internet, but thank you very much.
Thank you.